WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Hugh Masekela's record Grazin' in the Grass was a top 10 hit in 1968. In some ways, that record foreshadowed the current international popularity of Afropop, that's African music influenced by rock, soul, and jazz. Masekela is a South African composer and trumpeter who left his country in the early 60s on a music scholarship and never returned. After his brief commercial success in the United States, he spent much of the 70s performing in African countries, touring with some of the top African bands. He recently returned to the spotlight in the United States when he performed on Paul Simon's Graceland tour. Masekela just concluded a series of concerts with exiled South African singer Miriam Makeba, to whom he was briefly married after he first came to America. His music is also represented on Broadway in the current hit show Serafina. Before we hear from Hugh Masekela, let's listen to an excerpt from his latest album called Tomorrow. This is a song he co-composed called Bring Him Back Home about Nelson Mandela. Masekela is featured on trumpet and vocals. This was recorded live in concert in Harare, Zimbabwe. Masekela, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by talking with you about growing up in South Africa and then work our way to the work that you're doing now. Now, the first instrument that you played was piano before you switched to trumpet. Was it hard to get access to a piano growing up in South Africa?
No, you know, from the turn of the century, South Africa had ragtime bands and revues and Dixieland bands because there was a big industrial boom there with the discovery of all the minerals and... As a result, I would say that a great onslaught was experienced from the international money community. And they brought their Victrolas and their records with them, and they brought their instruments, and there was radio and all that. So the Africans, as a cheap labor force, but also people who liked, who had ears for music, had a lot of access to instruments. There were brass bands and... They were like black bottom joints and shebeens and municipal halls where a whole lot of bands played. And there were, I mean, in South Africa today, when you walk around, there's guys called Jelly Roll or Buddy Bolden or Satchmo or Duke or Count, you know. And
so you listened to a lot of jazz yourself when you were growing up?
I was weaned on jazz. So, like, there was a whole lot of piano players and also a lot of classical piano players in the townships, and the role model really of South African township life, I think, was like the African American experience of like the African people who, after the so-called emancipation, you know, came to the cities as cheap labor. They were able to popularize America, although it was Jim Crow to them, you know, through their music. And like, we grew up with Duke Ellington and Cy Oliver and Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong and Buddy Bolden and Jelly Roll Morton and King Oliver.
You played
Baby
in
Dolls, you know, could go on forever.
Yeah. You played in a lot of bands when you were growing up. Now, I understand that one of the bands you played in was the first black show that authorities allowed whites and quote, mixed races to see. What was that experience like? Is that true, first of all? I always have to check these things.
Well, I would say that, but I played in African jazz and variety. When I joined African jazz and variety, they were like a big touring review of 60 people, you know. Miriam Makeba joined it about a year after I did. But it had all like the singing stars of South Africa. And it had also groups like the Woodpeckers, who were like a cross between a rhythm and blues group maybe, and the Hi-Los, you know, the Four Freshmen with the Township thing. And there was a comedian, there was, you know, a guy who could sing like Nat King Cole, one guy could sing like Satch, and these all are big stars. But in certain towns, like in Cape Town, which was like a very liberal town then, and in Durban, they would allow mixed crowds, but they would be so far from the townships anyway that only, I would say, like people who had cars or access to transport, because the townships are about 15 to 20 miles out of town, would be able to come. And a lot of people who had like what I'd call permits, because when you were black in South Africa, you had to have a night pass to be in an urban area, a white area, after 9 o'clock in the evening. And you'd have to have a night pass and a letter signed by either your boss or your employer if you're a musician. And so it didn't make it very easy, but I don't think there was ever excitement in South Africa in token being, you know, sort of a token member of an integrated concert or integrated this and that, because the reality of the place has always been, I think South Africans are basically, oppressed South Africans are very clear when they focus on what they want. And I don't think it's so much to integrate with people as much as to be as free as them and be able to have a choice, just like all free people have, you know. When, for instance, the Morality Act was cut out in South Africa, where people were not supposed to make love across the color line. And when they took that, they thought there'd be like a big onslaught of interracial coupling and all that. But people have basically ignored it, because I don't think that it encompasses their vision of what freedom is about, or what freedoms are about.
My guest is trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela. When you left South Africa, you left on a music scholarship to study in England and America. How were you able to get the scholarship? And I should ask you first, did you plan on leaving for good? Did you want to get out of South Africa for good when you accepted that scholarship?
Well, when I was 13 years old, I saw a movie about the great Bix Beiderbecke called Young Man with a Horn.
Oh, yeah, with Kirk Douglas.
Right.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was in boarding school, and the school belonged to a community of monks from England called the Community of the Resurrection, of which Trevor Huddleston, which is Bishop Trevor Huddleston now, and is head of anti-apartheid and defense and aid, you know, it's, in England, was the chaplain of and the superior of this community. And they worked in health, welfare, and education among Africans. And he was also kind of a hoodlum priest. And I was going through a very rough time with the authorities at the boarding school. And I was called to him, and he said, "What do you really want to do? Because you're so young to expel." And I said, "Father, I just saw a movie called Young Man with a Horn, and if I can get a trumpet, I'll never bother anybody again." So he went to the local store and said, "You know, I got £15. There's a guy who might come and steal this horn if we, you know, can make a deal and buy it for him." And of course, the rest was history. But from there on, I got into like, you know, I was already past swing. And I was a very big collector. I'd, you know, grown up with my aunts and uncles, and my parents were all very, very big collectors of the breakable 78s. And I got into bebop. So by the time I was 15, 16, I was playing with Mbaqanga bands and with like groups like African Jazz when it went on the road, and Township Jazz, and jazz groups and modern jazz concerts, and mostly dance bands. But I started to become a student of bebop, and that pulled me more and more into like my horn and into like figuring that I had such a deep love, you know, for, I mean, I had enjoyed Dizzy Gillespie, I enjoyed Louis Armstrong and, you know, trumpeters of before, but people like Miles Davis and Fats Navarro and like Clifford Brown especially just blew me away. And I said, well, I have to be able to go where these guys can learn to play like that. And I knew that, of course, the main destination was New York. I mean, there was people in Johannesburg who were jazz collectors who could tell you where Charlie Parker was playing anywhere in the States on a certain date and who'd be on bass and who'd be on drums. Someone that were really very deep into it and they could, like, skate along with all the songs.
Well, when you got to America and you actually had some access to the people who you'd been listening to for so long, were you able to play with them? And did your rhythms, which were kind of African-based jazz, work well with theirs?
When I got here, I was really a hard, you know, bebop player, but everybody and all the musicians that I met, especially, you know, Dizzy and Belafonte, said, well, you know, a whole lot of people can do what you're doing, you know, as far as bebop is concerned, but there's something else that you have from your home, and if you can sort of come to a marriage with what you have traditionally or like just culturally from your home with what you know about the music here, you might come out with a hybrid of your own that people might be turned on to.
Well, you know, the record that introduced you to most Americans was the 1968 top 10 hit Grazin' in the Grass. I want to play just a few seconds of that to just remind our listeners of how the record sounded. And I should tell you, this is an old, scratchy copy from a friend's collection. So we'll just play a few seconds of it just to refresh memories about Hugh Masekela's 1968 hit. A lot of our listeners have copies as scratchy as that one. what was the story? Yeah. What was the story behind this song? Was that the song that you wanted to record? And
I think the majority of the people who bought that record or danced to it are grandparents now. No, this record. I went to Los Angeles in 1966 because of a record I made live at the Village Gate with the late Tom Wilson, who at the time was also producing Bob Dylan and Paul Simon, someone in Garfunkel, among other things. But this record we did live at the Gate, and it broke out after 2 years. We did it in 64, and in 66 it became like the number one record in California. And I went there to play the first Watts Jazz Festival. I'd been playing as an opening band all the time at the Village Gate from time to time. And when I played the first Watts Festival, the night I played, over 15,000 people came, and it was like a record attendance. So I called my friend, Stuart Levine, you know, later became my partner and produced most of my albums. I said, man, this is the place we should be, not coming back. So I had quite a big success in California. And in 1967, I recorded a cover of The Fifth Dimension's Up, Up and Away, and that went into the top 30. And I started traveling all over the country, and I took a vacation and went to see my sister who was at university in Lusaka. A lot of friends who hadn't seen me for 7 years came from Johannesburg, and, you know, they brought, like, tape and pieces of stuff. And when I came back, I had a lot of Mbakanga music. And the late El Abreu, who played with me on Grazing in that quintet I had, we were in the studio doing the album, Promise of a Future. We needed about 4 minutes more on the album, and we didn't have another song. And El Abreu said, remember that? So he liked it very much. He said, there's that song, man, that you always play, that we always play. You know, we should try and do that because it's a simple part. So I just showed the piano player what to do and sang the four notes to the bass player. And we did it in one take. And 6 weeks later, it was number one.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela, and we'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. South African trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela is my guest. Before we talk more, I want to play some more of your music. There's a hit on Broadway called Serafina now, and you wrote some of the music for that, and you were one of the people behind the creation of the show. I want to play the title song from Serafina, which you wrote. Hugh Masekela doesn't perform on this, but you wrote the music and the lyrics, or just the music?
Well, I collaborated with the director, Mbongeni Ngema.
And you did the horn arrangements on this as well.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it was like really a collaboration because most of it was rehearsed in South Africa, and then we rehearsed it here for 2 months, and added this and took that and that out. But it's been like a 2-year collaboration.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen. Title song from the Broadway hit Serafina, and my guest Hugh Masekela composed that. You know, after that hit in 1968 that we were talking about, Grazing in the Grass, I think a lot of people lost track of you. You went to Africa for a long time in the 1970s. Did you kind of give up on America for a period there?
Not really. I mean, to a certain extent, coming from an oppressed people, having a major success at the level and the brouhaha to which it goes, you know, in its marketplace. And of course, it was also a period of like anti-Vietnam War activity. And it was like the Black Power situation. And a conservative government had just come in who were like a very anti-musician. And I'd been living in California. And I just felt I'd peaked, but like that the success was irrelevant in juxtaposition to the position of my people. And although South Africa was inaccessible to me, I just felt like I should get back into somewhere in Africa. And I was crazy about the music of Zaire and of Ghana and Guinea and Nigeria. And I had a few friends there, so I gave myself an open ticket.
Was that a good experience for you? What I'm thinking is, you said when you got to New York that a lot of the jazz musicians who you wanted to play with said to you, do what's unique to you. Play African music as well. Everyone, you know, plays bebop. Play what's really like your music. And there you were in Africa getting reunited with African musical forms. Was that a good experience for you, a kind of growth experience musically?
I think it was very spiritual, too, because it was a pilgrimage. I was from Africa, but I'd never been there.
You'd only stayed in your township?
Right, in South Africa. Well, and South Africa, and I'd been to Botswana once, but it's different, you know. I got, like, I spent 7 years where I lived with, the peoples of Guinea, of Ghana, of Zaire, of Nigeria, and I got to learn the languages and, the slang and the way to walk and talk and just the culture and tradition there. And it was a great revelation to me. Also, like, from a socio-political view, I got to know what Africa is like. I mean, I've traveled all over Senegal, Togo, Benin, Kenya. And there's nothing like seeing it firsthand. And of course, once it bites you, you always have to go back. I kept making glimpses into the States with the African band from West Africa, but I was experiencing, I was absorbing the continent.
What's your status now with South Africa? Could you return there? Are you officially in exile, if you know what I mean?
My status with South Africa is that I don't recognize the government thereof. Mm-hmm. And that's our status. That's our relationship. You know, I don't think they think what we who oppose them stand for is a legitimate stand, because they live in a world that is almost cultist, you know, in its form and philosophy. So it's a situation where I don't recognize the government, or it's true that I don't think they can exile me. You know what I mean? I'm in self exile because of the situations in South Africa. And I've been, not only outspoken in South Africa, but to a certain extent, very harsh when I've had access to the media. So I don't think I'm one of their favorite people. But that's not the aim. The aim is to be able to define them to the world, so the world can see them as they really are. And what they really are is an occupying force in the townships and the schools and hospitals and homes and minds of the people who own the country, what they have in bondage. And it's like a situation where it's worse than a slave state.
Do you still have your recording studio in Botswana?
In 1985, the South African government sent commandos into Gaborone to come and murder political exiles whose homes they claimed were terrorist camps. And of course, a lot of these people were friends and or relatives of mine. And of course, although my house was not so much pinpointed as a terrorist house, it was nevertheless, when I was laying there with my wife for 2 hours listening to the commandos murder and bomb people all over the place, it was a definite sign that it was not the greatest place to live in. And of course, other messages were sent based on that. The government really couldn't secure that they could, you know, guarantee our security, you know, especially South African exiles who were outspoken against the government. And it felt like a time to go. So we just had to get rid of the studio, too, instead of seeing it go up in smoke.
I don't want to go into the whole thing about, you know, you toured with Graceland in America, and I don't want to go into the whole thing again about whether you think it was okay for Paul Simon to record in South Africa. But I'm curious if you're ambivalent yourself about the performance and recording ban in South Africa.
Well, I think that just like I don't recognize the South African government, I don't think that people can, like, overseas elect themselves to, like, sort of judge and make a way of how South African music should be made accessible to people in the world. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And myself, personally, when I worked in Botswana, I was criticized for working with South African governments. And I always said to everybody, if I can't work with the people of my country, you know, who I admire and I have access to them and they have access to me, then there'll be something wrong with me, because I'll be pulling them back, because my aim is for them to be able to have the same recognition that I've gotten, not, or even better, because a lot of them are better than that. Otherwise, I mean, like a person like Jonathan Butler just came out recently, should be illegal because he still goes home. But we're proud of our talents, and all the people in the townships are proud of their musicians. They boast about them, and they're always like a football team, or, you know, it's a... If we send our people overseas, you know, they could, like, kick some butt, you know, or, like, show what they can really do. And that is an aspiration that we have for all our people. So based on that, I think that whoever put up the rules, I mean, since then the situation has been settled, but they were aware that, if anything, they should have had some kind of delegation from the South African Music and Arts Committee before they could make decisions for them. Because when Paul went to South Africa, he didn't go to perform, he didn't go to take anything from them, but he took his own expertise, technology, and money out of something that had affected him very, very emotionally and spiritually. And I think he did a fantastic job with it, because Mambazo's won a Grammy. People had forgotten about Miriam, and I just finished a very successful tour with her. She has a book out, and she has a record out that has been getting rave reviews everywhere. I think that I have, I mean, I had, without Serafina, also, I still like, I think I have had more exposure also through Graceland. And of course, a lot of South African musicians and African music as a whole. And between the Grammys and the reception we've got from what I call non-converts, you know, because sometimes like the converts think that like this situation just belongs to them. But I think what was greatest about Graceland is that it brought something that people thought was belonged to a private club. It brought it to the back gardens of the barbecuing middle and upper middle class. And they found that even when they like South African music, that as simple as that, they found that there's a problem there. And those 10 million people we didn't have on our side before Graceland, you know. And it's to a certain extent, traditionally, we just feel that a thing like that is not an accident and it's spiritual. But the most the fantastic thing is that not only did Paul share his royalties with all the writers and still has a great relationship with everybody and is very happy about it's been uplifting for him. It's been uplifting for the people in South Africa, too, and for African musicians as a whole. And
you've been touring now with Miriam McCabe. I think that the tour has just concluded.
Yeah.
What's it been like, again, to perform together again? When you came to America, she helped you out a lot, and then you were married for a while as well. Has that been an interesting reunion?
Well, even though Miriam was not here, and you know, I've been performing with Miriam all through the years, through the last 17 years, because we perform all over Africa.
I see.
And we perform all over Europe, where I think people are not as narrow-minded, I mean, from especially a governmental position, to like ban or blacklist artists, you know, for their beliefs. So I've always been on her records. I've produced a lot of her records, and I work with her all the time.
Okay.
And it was a great, great opportunity when we had an opportunity to work here together, but it was nothing new to us.
One last thing. Do people still see you and just associate you with Grazing in the Grass, or is that all over? Do you have like a separate identity from that in America for most listeners?
I have a multi-identity in this country because I've been here for 28 years, and through those years I've evolved so many times that it depends on one's age, you know.
Right, right. Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for interviewing.
My guest has been South African trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela, and he wrote some of the music for the Broadway hit Serafina. He's also just concluded a tour with Miriam Makeba. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.